Now, we need to be really careful because we have some big tech companies that might become the future banks. And those people are even more powerful than your bank. And that, to me, is a fascinating conversation that we need to have.
Thanks again for joining us at the Empire's New Clothes. This is where we discuss the forces that make and break empires. I'm your host, Brad from MacArthur. Today, we're speaking with Antonio Fadas. He's a professor of economics at INSEAD in Singapore, and he spends much of his time thinking and writing about the business cycle, cryptocurrencies, and central bank digital currencies. We dive into all those in this very fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy. Antonio, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's early morning for you in Singapore right now, my evening. So thanks for making the time difference work out.
Yep, that is a pleasure to be here.
All right. So you've got quite a background in economics. And, you know, I just got to ask, what was your initial interest? Why did you first get started in economics whenever you took that first leap?
I think it was a combination of I like technical subjects, so I used to like more scientific subjects when I was studying. But I also had sort of an interest in understanding sort of social dynamics, economic outcomes. So I thought economics was a good combination of both, and it turned out that it is, because it is, in particular, if you're an academic, a fairly technical subject. And it obviously, yeah, some of the research that we do has implications for society as a whole. Yeah.
And then, you know, it's obviously very applicable to your everyday life, but someone who has never thought a moment about economics, how is it applicable to the rest of us?
I mean, a lot of what we deal with on a daily basis has to do with economic outcomes, right? I mean, what are the living standards in the country you live? Obviously, it's very different across countries. What is going to happen when there's a crisis? What is the role of governments or central banks during crisis? I mean, those are things that we all live by. We suffer them, we enjoy them, and understanding where those outcomes come from, and in some cases, how to make them better for society, at least to me, was a very attractive proposition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you have any close family or friends that just are bored to death when you start talking about economics?
I mean, it happens to be that my brother, who happens to be older than I am, ended up going into economics as well. So he's also an academic, but he's the only one in the family that did anything.
Okay.
In economics.
So when you guys meet up for family gatherings, you can have your little corner, you can do the huddle, talk about economics, and everyone's like, yeah.
We try to avoid it. Also, he does research on issues which are almost orthogonal to the research that I do. So our research does not overlap at all.
Oh, okay. Cool. And so, you know, I've read some of your work, and you talk a lot about economic scars, economic memories, and I thought that was a really unique way to put it, because humans have memories, communities, we evolve through time, we have collective memories, and it sounds like you're saying economies have memories in a way. Can you elaborate more on that?
Yeah, I mean, some of my research is a little bit about understanding, how do you get to a point where an economy is? I mean, if you look at any economy around the world, whether it's the US or Singapore or Europe, what do economic outcomes, where do economic outcomes come from? And there's sort of a theory in economics that says, look, when you go through bad times, when you go through recessions, it sort of doesn't matter at the end of the day. We get out of recessions, we sort of come back to normal, we recover. Now, some of my research says that's not completely true. What you went through matters for the future as well. So if you go through a recession, you find yourself 10 years down the road or even 20 years down the road at a place which is still affected by the history you went through. So that's what it means that economies have memories, that history matters. So it's not just to say that we always come back to some nice equilibrium. It's more complicated than that. And it makes the job of policymakers more challenging, because you really have to pay attention to where we are today if you care about where you want to be 20 years from now.
Yeah. Have any of those mainstream opinions or thoughts on economic memories, have you seen them changing over the course of your career? Is this more of a considered viewpoint?
So they have, for sure. I mean, when I started doing this research, it was more than 20 years ago. And the economic circumstances in those years, which is sometime in the 90s, early 2000s, were such mm-hmm. that these type of effects were not visible, were not that large. Even if they were there in the data, in particular, they were there for other countries, not the US. But in the US, they were not that large. So a lot of the academic community did not think this was a priority for research. Now, the global financial crisis happened, and that one for sure left these big scars in many economies, including the advanced economies. So then this topic came back to the academic community as people realized, well, this is an interesting topic to discuss. With mm-hmm. the COVID crisis, with the global pandemic, again, it was an issue that was very relevant because we had an event that was quite unique. And it was very interesting to ask the question, again, how long is it going to stay with us? So I think the last two recessions have been quite special and have created a momentum to think harder about these issues.
Yeah, well, let's dive in a little bit. What are some of those memories or the lasting impacts from, say, the Great Financial Crisis? And then we can maybe bring it more today and look forward of what might be the next memories from the COVID crisis.
Yeah, so it's interesting because the global financial crisis, from the perspective of these memories, was clearly one of the worst crises we've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. It was a crisis that was already long per se, but if you look at the effects of the crisis 5-10 years down the road, they were still there. So the US economy had not gone back to the trajectory they had before the financial crisis 10 years later. The European economies were even farther away from that trajectory. So clearly, whatever happens during the financial crisis, despite some of the good years we had afterwards, we never truly recover from that crisis. And I think this is a testament that says when you have a crisis which is deep, which is financial, which is long, some of those scars are going to be really deep and might stay with you for a long time.
Have you, in your research, do you look at generational effects at all of how it affects different age brackets and cohorts throughout time? Or is it more macro, just looking at the greater economy?
It's more of a macro statement. There's some interesting research. I haven't done that research myself that looks at sort of labor market outcomes that says, look, mm-hmm. if you lose your job in the middle of a crisis, how long is it going to take you to go back to normal? If you graduate from college at a time when there's a crisis, what does your future career look like? There's some interesting, once again, effects that depend on history. Graduating during a recession means that your career is going to look quite different from someone who graduated from the same school with the same skills in good times. So there are some effects. I'm not sure it's about generations, yeah. but certainly it's about different points in your labor market career.
And how about looking forward, what might be some of the long-lasting impacts from the current COVID crisis?
So this one it's been a very interesting one. I think when it started, we were all in the dark. I mean, what is it going to look mm-hmm. like 2, 3, 4 yeah. years down the road? What we've learned today, and things might change still because it's an ongoing event, what we learned today is that we recover quite fast from this crisis. Quite the contrary to the financial crisis, we're almost back to normal. So our guess today, again, it might change soon, but I guess today is that this is a crisis that is not going to have large scars on the economy. That if you do sort of a projection of the path of the US economy or the European economies, any advanced economy before the crisis and where we are today, we're quite close. Given a couple of years, we'll almost be at the same place. So from that perspective, this is a positive outcome. We do not see the same scars we saw in the global financial crisis. Of course, this crisis being so special is questioning many other things. Are we all going to go back and work in the office? Are some people who decided to retire going to come back to the labor market? And those are very interesting questions. We don't have enough data. We have lots of phenomena that are new today, but it's very hard to tell what this phenomenon is going to look like in 5 years' time.
Yeah. Well, that's obviously quite great news. And do we have any type of hypotheses or any data pointing to why it might be different this time? Or what is
my research? I've been looking at sort of all previous cycles in the US in particular. Mm-hmm. The US economy is a very interesting economy to study because the cycles are very clean. They're very clear. You know when a recession is there in the data. You know when the recovery starts. So it's sort of easy to study for an academic like myself. And what you typically see, crises that are short-lived, they tend to leave less scars, fewer scars going forward. So okay, this is a little bit what would explain the current crisis. This is, in some sense, the shortest recession ever. if you go by the dates that economies use, this is the shortest recession by a large amount. So this was, again, if you measure in months or quarters from the beginning of the recession to the end, it is the shortest recession ever. So that matches that story. Again, we have to be careful. We don't have that much data. This is a quite unique recession, so it's hard to compare it to the 1981 recession or any other. But that sort of feeds the story of the all the previous cycles.
And how might the fiscal and monetary responses fit into that? Were they more powerful on a percentage basis than before? Or how can we dive into those and like piece that out a little bit?
Yeah, you could also argue, again, this is also consistent with previous crises, that we had policies that were more aggressive. And I think they were more aggressive partly because of what we lived through in the global financial crisis. So we went through a crisis that was painful and persistent. And I think policymakers decided to be a lot more aggressive this time, in particular in the US. I think the US is probably the best example, where fiscal policy has been a lot more aggressive than during the global financial crisis. So that for sure has helped. Again, how much it has helped, I think you need to give me a few more years to have more data to be able to do the right research. But anecdote, if you look at it as an anecdote, for sure, it sort of fits the paradigm that we've seen in previous crises.
Yeah. And does it feel like we might have learned something from that? Like, in your view, this also might be not so much data-driven, but are there any guesses that next time perhaps we're going to do similar, like very quick, very powerful responses?
Is there anything although at the same time, every cycle is different. So as we speak, in particular in the US, there's some concerns about inflation. Some would argue that maybe we did too much. So you could also come up with a lesson that says, well, maybe now we overdid it. We sort of the pendulum swung too much to the other side. Yeah. So maybe the next crisis, some are going to be more careful because of the inflation dynamics we see today. Now, to me, the answer will depend what happens to inflation over the next couple of years. If inflation stays very persistent, I could imagine going back to sort of a more muted response in the next cycle. I think that's a problem with policymaking during recessions. We don't have that many recessions in the history of any economy. Mm. And each of these recessions is different. And we try to come up with sort of a recipe for the next recession. But who knows what the next recession would be called for? So I think I agree with you. Probably we'll be aggressive next time. But I want to be careful because we're still not done with the current cycle in some way. So there might be lessons that we still learn over the next couple of years.
Yeah, not getting ahead of ourselves there. So there were some, not historically new, but new from a more modern perspective, fiscal responses. So there's helicopter money, there is some like direct payments from the government. And how might that have changed the macro landscape in the moment? And then also perhaps talking about from the perspective of these economic memories, what might be some lasting memories from that?
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, I tend to stay away a little bit with some labels, which are sometimes hard to interpret. I think the type of fiscal policy that we've seen, the type of monetary policy we've seen, I tend to look at it as quite a standard. You might want to call it more aggressive, possibly. It is true that we've innovated a little bit in the way we've implemented these policies over time. So we have different instruments. The concept of quantitative easing was sort of not around before the global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. Now, as an academic, I could say, well, but it's not too far from sort of the notion of increasing liquidity, that sort of a statement that we've been making many times before. So I tend to see the current policies as sort of innovations over a paradigm that was already there. I don't see them as radically different. Some of the sort of new proposals that are being discussed, I think there's a lot of semantic discussions when we talk about whether it's helicopter money, when we talk about modern monetary theory. I mean, there's a lot of these labels which are interesting, and I think they're going to advance our knowledge. But I think they're sort of tweaking the type of tools we've used before. We need to do the tweaking because, again, circumstances change. But I think fundamental, I still look at monetary and fiscal policy the same way I looked at them in any of the previous cycles. Can we try to get them better, more effective? But I don't think fundamentally we've reinvented any of these tools.
Interesting. Okay. And so since we're doing fundamentally similar things, yet we're seeing inflation numbers being a little more, raising more this time than last time. So in that context, what has changed?
I mean, the inflation number, the way I read them, with a lot of uncertainty, because again, we're going to have to wait some time to understand some of this phenomenon, is this was a unique recovery. It's unique in two ways. First, it has been very fast. So again, that's obvious. It's the fastest recovery we've ever seen. Second, we come back from a situation that was highly unusual. Again, a pandemic is not a financial crisis. It's something very different. We shut down economies. We shifted our consumption patterns dramatically. And you and I have spent a lot of time at our homes, not going out to restaurants, but we had the ability to look at our computer and order online whatever we wanted. Because our incomes have stayed quite stable during this crisis, partly because of the intervention of governments, we had the income to spend. But we were not going to spend it on some of the typical things we bought, which is what we call services, whether it's going to a restaurant or traveling. So we're going to spend it somewhere else. So you have a large increase in demand, which is sort of shifted towards some specific sectors, sectors where it's not easy just to produce a lot more in a short period of time. If we're all buying computers, if we're all buying phones, if we're all buying goods, it's just not easy to ship these things across the world, which is how we do it in a globalized economy. So if you look at the data, we're shipping more goods than ever. In particular, if you look at the US, ports are just sort of moving goods around at a speed that they've never done before. So on one hand, you would say things are working. Things are working quite well, but we push things to the limit. And we found the bottlenecks, and we found the bottlenecks in different places, whether it is a factory in Vietnam that cannot work at 100% because COVID is still around, whether it's a port in China, whether it's a port in the US. Yes, if you try to push things faster than ever, you're going to find those bottlenecks. And that's where you see this inflation coming up in many places in the US and in other countries. So for sure, those phenomena are there. Now, is there more than that? Is there a situation where inflation is sort of detaching from the targets that the central banks have? I don't see that. Others do. Others worry that there's some more of a permanent component here. Now, I think we're going to have to resolve that in a few years. At this point, we have this sort of disagreements about to what extent we're doing something which is more damaging or is purely a phenomenon that it had to be there because this is a very unusual recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love your measured approach there. And that's so true. We're just going to have to wait and figure that out. Yeah. And so I guess in the more common nomenclature, that would put you more in the transitory camp.
Yeah, I mean, as probably you've heard, that word is a loaded one on the chairman.
Yeah, it is.
Let's not use that word anymore. But I am in the sense that I think about phenomena which are special, which are unique to the crisis. And if you let time pass, a lot of these bottlenecks are going to go away. So that's probably something that you would call transitory. But again, today, that's a very loaded word.
Yeah. And so let's change gears a little bit into the another loaded word, cryptocurrency or digital assets. And you spend a lot of time writing about them. And so in your view, because people aren't even agreeing on the definition of these things, in your view, what is a digital asset?
I mean, in my view, a digital asset is an asset that is stored in digital form. I think that's the standard definition that I would give. And there are many out there. There have been many around for many decades. My bank account is a digital asset. That's what it is. It's sitting on a server. There's a record on a server that says the bank owes me some money. I have an asset that is sitting at the bank, and I can transfer that asset to you by sending a transfer across borders, and I'm transferring value to you. So that's an asset. It captures value. It can be transferred, and it's done digitally. So digital assets have been around. What we're seeing today sort of is a wave of digital assets that are in a form and that they're ruled by a governance that is very different from the traditional bank account that all of us have used for many decades.
Mm-hmm. And if you're thinking about it as a revolutionary technology or financial speculation, where might it fit on that spectrum? Or does it cover both of those?
I mean, to me, again, the digitalization of assets has been around for a while. It has done great things for all of us. What we're talking about today, or what some are talking about today, is a revolution in governance. The idea that we've run the financial system through intermediaries. Intermediaries is your bank, my bank. Intermediaries is whomever runs the stock exchange, right? So those people are central to the management and transfer of digital assets. Now, what some of the decentralized propositions are is let's get rid of this layer. Again, there's a label which I'm not very happy with, which is let's make finance more democratic. And uh-huh. more democratic means that sort of we can get rid of the layer of intermediaries. So you and I make the final decision on governance, the final decision on who's right, who's wrong, if there's a dispute, right? So that sounds like a revolution. It's not so much the technology, although there's some interesting technological advances as well, that would be a revolution to have a world where transactions in the financial sector are sort of run without intermediaries. Now, whether that can be successful, whether that can work, that's an open question. I'm very skeptical. Mm-hmm. Not as skeptical because of the technology, because of the logic that you can run commercial operations the way we run them in the financial system by having a bunch of people who vote on who's right and who's wrong. I still don't see how that model can work. But I might be mm-hmm. wrong. It might be that there's something that I don't see yet in that governance.
Well, again, enjoying your measured approach there. And let's reach back to the idea of economic memories. And so how might trauma from the Great Financial Crisis impact people's excitement or desire to purchase cryptocurrencies or tokens or any of these digital assets today?
I mean, clearly, Bitcoin was born to some extent as a reaction to the global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. If we read sort of the white paper of Bitcoin by Satoshi Nakamoto, he sort of refers to banks a few times. He refers to creating a revolution that sort of replaces the current system with a different one. And there's a reference to some events during the global financial crisis. So clearly that crisis left some people very unhappy with banks, that there's no doubt about it. Now, what I find a little bit surprising is where Bitcoin has evolved, where sort of decentralized finance has evolved, it sort of looked like an alternative that looks very much like banks. So yeah. A lot of people are still buying and selling cryptocurrencies through centralized exchanges, through intermediaries. Who is the one who's really making money in that world? The intermediaries, who are charging, in some cases, very high fees in those exchanges. What happens every day? I mean, over the last 2 days, we've seen news like this. One of these exchanges gets hacked. And it gets hacked because the intermediary is not regulated and is using a technology which is not up to the standards of today. And some people lose money. So on one hand, yes, that's how we started. But if you look at where we're ending up, at least today, it still is the same system. You still have to rely on a lot of intermediaries. I mean, I use an example. Many people say this is like the internet revolution in the 1990s. So the internet was a way to democratize technology because now we all can send emails to each other. We can all do a video conference with each other without intermediaries. But that's not correct. Your email address and my email address probably runs through some server which is managed by a big corporation, right? That's how it works. We still have mm-hmm. plenty of intermediaries. Now, there is a sense of decentralization, peer-to-peer communications on the internet. Of course it is. But it's still managed by organizations that have a legal entity. They're accountable. And if the system doesn't work, you can complain to someone. So even the internet, which is seen as a great example of a decentralized technology, and obviously a very successful one, still requires intermediaries. So I think to me, the right question is, what type of intermediaries do we want? How do we regulate them? Are they working well? I mean, that's a very good conversation to have. How do we improve the current system? I think going to an ideal scenario where there's no intermediaries, I just don't find that to be realistic, whether it's the internet or whether it's in decentralized finance.
Yeah. So in your view, then, what is the ultimate value of this somewhat new asset class? Of course, you made the great point. It's not necessarily that new, but we have like blockchain and we have this new form of governance. And so is it regulatory arbitrage? Is it this very powerful narrative of kind of fighting back against that anti-elite, what you say is born out of the Great Financial Crisis? or is it something different?
I mean, if you look at the people who are today investing in these assets, there is a little bit of regulatory arbitrage for sure, because you're doing business in a way which is sort of cheaper than a regular bank or a regular institution. Mm-hmm. But the majority of people are looking into this market saying it is the future. And because it is the future, it's going to go up in value. And because it's going to go up in value, I should buy it today. That is, to me, the majority of people who are in this world. Now, how do they justify that this is the future in different ways? Again, some people go back to this idea, this is going to be a democratic version of the financial system. Some talk about something else. Some big players might say, I don't understand it. I'm not sure why it's the future. But if everyone believes that is the future, then I'm going to buy a piece of it. So that's what I see today. Today, we live under the hope that this is indeed the future. Because if this is not the future, I don't think the logic that many investors have will work. But again, that's a lot of betting on something that we don't understand. I mean, I personally have a hard time betting on something that I don't understand, even if I see other people betting on it. But obviously, that's not how many other people work. Many other people feel if everyone is into it, there must be a good reason for it. Now, that's to me a little bit dangerous. It does resemble previous bubbles, which is how bubbles get created. And I personally would like to see more the fundamental logic behind this model, the business model, before I think this is a great investment.
Mm-hmm. I get the feeling you're not the person who enjoys making predictions, and especially not when they're being recorded. With that caveat, do you think about it all? What might be the end game of this? Is it like, I just fully don't know, or like 50% a bubble, 50% could be something, or where do you fall along that line?
And what I see is, I mean, people compare cryptocurrencies to gold, and I'd like to make that comparison myself. Gold is a market which is not well understood by anyone. Why do people buy gold? Why is it that the price of gold goes up and down? It's clearly not related to the use of gold in jewelry and other industrial applications. It's not. Is clearly related to people that at times says gold is a great asset, let me buy it because it's a great investment. Now, if you look over long periods of time, is gold a great investment? It's not. If you buy the stock market, you're going to do better. Is gold a great hedge against inflation, which many people would argue is not. It is not true that when inflation goes up, gold is a great hedge. It's not. So what do you have at the end? You have investors that have some beliefs about the properties of gold, that buy it on a regular basis. Sometimes they buy it more, sometimes they buy it less, because I don't know, the narrative changes over time. The asset is still around. I don't think it's gonna go away. I don't think the price of gold will be zero soon. And I don't think it's gonna crash from its current value. I don't know when it's gonna go down, but I don't have a fundamental view of the gold market. So it's very hard for me to make a prediction because it does depend on the narrative of that market. I think cryptocurrencies are on the same boat. Yes, I don't see the business model that they are based on being successful, that I can bet on it, that I can forecast. Like, I'm happy to make a forecast. This is not going to work. But I cannot make a forecast on the price of these currencies, because as long as someone thinks, but it will work in 100 years, I'll buy it, then the price will stay what it is, or it will go up if there's more than one person, or it will go down if now people start getting a little bit more pessimistic. So I assume these things are going to be around for a while. I don't see them disappearing. I don't see the value of these cryptocurrencies, in particular the big ones. The small ones are disappearing every day. But mm-hmm. They can stay around for a long time as long as people see a value the way they see a value in gold as a hedge against inflation or as something else. Now, it's very hard for me to predict something that I cannot understand.
Certainly. And so what about the use case for a central bank digital currency? You've written a bit about this, and let's just start off. What is a central bank digital currency? And then dive in a little more from there.
Yeah, so the idea is quite simple. Central banks today have accounts for banks. So all banks have an account at the central bank. So a central bank is a bank of banks. And then commercial banks are the banks of people like you or I. Now, the notion of central bank digital currency is very simple. Let's bypass the banks. Let's bypass the intermediaries. So you and I can have an account at the central bank. Now, it will be digital for sure, because we live in a digital world, the same way your regular bank account is digital. So the digital part is not at all an innovation. The innovation would be that instead of providing digital accounts for banks, it would be digital accounts for everyone. That's really the innovation that we have here. And why would that be important or interesting? Now, one could argue, well, it makes the system simpler. Because rather than you going through your bank and your bank through the central bank, why don't we go straight to the central bank? Why don't we all bank with the same bank? And I think from an efficiency point of view, that sounds right. That sounds interesting. But the problem is that cannot be the final outcome, because there's no way for the central bank to be the only bank in the world. You have to have commercial banks. So you cannot just say, let's go to the most efficient outcome. We all bank with the central bank, because we need banks, commercial banks, to give mortgages, to give loans, and they need to stick around. So what is central bank digital currency? It's sort of opening a new avenue, if you want, a new pipe in the financial system that can be useful at times. Now, we're still thinking carefully. Is this good enough? Is this necessary? When do we say that this is going to be useful at times? When is it going to be useful? And there's no simple answer, because every country looks different. So if I'm sitting in Nigeria, the commercial banks might be highly inefficient. And the central bank says, let me create a pipe in the financial system, which is faster than anything we've had before, that allows people to have access to digital money because they don't have it through the regular banks. That might make a lot of sense. But if you try to make the same argument in Sweden, where everyone has a bank account and everyone is using mobile payments every day, it's just not obvious. It's not as obvious. So then you have to find a different case for why central banks should do this. Now, the Central Bank of Sweden says, let me give you a different reason. In Sweden, we are worried that people don't use cash anymore. So they don't have access to any form of public money, because physical cash is obviously created by the government or the central bank. So we want to have an alternative that is fit for the modern world. So it's not about efficiency. Our system is very efficient. We don't need to improve it. But we need to be here as an alternative form of money in case people want to move away from the private sector. Now, that's a more philosophical approach to this question. It's not about efficiency. It's not about how fast payments are. It's about philosophically, I need to always, always have a form of money which is sort of backed 100% by the central bank. So that's the debate that we're having. It's not an easy one. It really varies by countries. I don't call it a revolution either. It's an interesting proposition, and I think it might work in some cases. But it's a nuanced debate, because it truly depends on which country you have in mind.
Well, I guess the question is, why now? Because if we've had the technology to bank with the central bank for a long time now, in some form, it happens to have shown up, this conversation now, in line with the rise of cryptocurrencies and digital assets and blockchain technology? Or is it come about because of the rise of blockchain technology?
So I think it's a confluence of many things, and some of them have to do with technologies that we've seen everywhere. So, I mean, there's so many trends happening at once. You have countries that are sort of moving away from physical cash, like Sweden is a perfect example. So the central bank feels, look, this is odd, that there's nothing that looks like central bank money. We've always had it, and now it's sort of going away. So that's a trend that has to do with the use of technology. There is all these cryptocurrencies and all this talk of different forms of digital money that did not exist before. So there's some pressure on central banks to do something. What about on your side? What are you doing? And I think there's some pressure to say, well, we're also there. We're also very modern. Then you have many emerging markets where technology is coming at the heart of payments, where many people have been unbanked. So people have been doing business with physical cash. And through different technologies that mostly have to do with the fact that we all have a mobile phone with us, now people can do payments very fast through the use of technology. So again, the central bank is rethinking, well, maybe I should be part of this story in some way, right? What is the final outcome? We don't know. So I think you have all these things going on at once. A lot of them are influenced by technology, the use of digital payments everywhere. which have been around forever, but they're sort of becoming more prevalent everywhere, in a store, in bank-to-bank transfers, peer-to-peer transfers. So I think the central bank is rethinking their role. It makes sense. And central bank digital currency is one of the potential ways to get the system right or to get some features that we didn't have before.
Yeah. And what about the average person? What are some downsides that it could have? Or some government implements a central bank digital currency and they've got some alternative goals of maybe controlling the money flows in certain ways or maybe cementing in class structures. Are you able to do that more with a central bank digital currency, or is it not really much different?
I mean, there's a question. It depends where you come from. If you come from a world where you're using cash, physical cash, any form of digital payment might sound risky to you because you lose anonymity, right? That's true about bank payments. That's true about central bank digital currency. So if you're being forced to move away from cash and you need anonymity, then for sure you feel this is a threat to you. Now, if you're a regular person who uses banks to do payments, so you use your credit card, your debit card, a bank-to-bank transfer, what you might see here is, well, maybe not the government is going to see even more than they already see. Because again, the government today can, in many cases, have access to information on your bank account. And mm-hmm. you cannot hide from the government when you are dealing with a regular bank. But you might say, but now they're going to truly see everything. So I'm really worried that they're going to use that information for other purposes. Now, if I was in China, I would be worried about that. Because, yes, I'm worried how the government will use information on my purchases, on my activities to create, again, a profile of me that can affect the way I interact with other people in China. Now, if I'm sitting in the US or I'm sitting in Europe, I would be a lot less worried about that because we give a lot of information to our governments already. And again, to some extent, there's proper regulations and checks and balances so that they don't abuse it too much. So I'm not sure this is so different from other things we already do in these countries. So in that case, I wouldn't panic that much. As a user, I would see that an alternative to doing payments that some people might love and some people might feel is not necessary. Life is okay the way it is today. So if you offer me one of these accounts, I'm not sure I might open it because I don't really need it as a user.
And I've seen some debate between this, the differing views of wholesale central bank digital currencies and retail. Can you separate those two for us a little bit?
Yeah, what happens is many people come to this with sort of complaints about how the payment system works today, right? So you're sitting in country X and you send money to your friend and it takes 3 days and the bank charges you 3%. You make a payment on a store and the credit card company charges 3% to the merchant. And you say, this seems to be a high number. This shouldn't be there, right? And things should just move really fast because if we live in a digital world, everything has to be immediate. So yeah. There's been a lot of work in many countries sort of fixing the architecture of payments. Now, payments, all of them go through the central bank. So the central bank already provides some form of digital currency to banks. So it's sort of a backbone of the payment system. So what many people say, fix the backbone. Now, we already have that backbone. So it's not about creating what we call wholesale CBDC, because we already have it. It's about improving it, making sure that it works fast, that it's cheap, that everyone can make these payments transfers in a way that is seamless, and it can be really, really costless compared to what it is today. Now, we've already done that in many countries. Again, the country where I live, Singapore, I can make payments peer-to-peer, bank account to a store that are immediate at zero mm-hmm. cost that bypass all the credit card, debit card companies. So they go straight from my account to your account. So this is a system that, if you want, is a wholesale system of central bank digital currency that works. And what matters is that works. I don't care whether you want to create yeah. something if it's not going to help me. Here is that works. So that's what wholesale CBDC is. It's more about improving the system that we have, making it work for everyone, for merchants, for individuals. And again, the goal is to make it fast, efficient, cheap, etc.
Gotcha. Well, you've taken us on a whirlwind tour of all these different wild assets and economic memories. Is there anything, we're probably wrapping up here, is there anything on your radar that you're working on a, you know, lately this month, or that's really caught your interest?
I mean, I'm working on exactly the issues that we've been discussing. I'm doing a lot of work trying to understand the current recovery in the context of other cycles. I think that's really a very interesting topic for an academic. And I still think that all the conversation we had about digital currencies, I'm very skeptical about some of the business models behind them, but I'm not as skeptical at all about the use of technology. I think we have come to an inflection point about how technology can improve the financial system. And I see that happening or happen already in some countries. And I see opportunities that are going to fuel conversations like this over the years to come.
Yeah. So if it's an inflection point, is it almost inevitable that technologies become more and more part of it? Or is there something that onus on us to help make those changes in the near future?
No, I mean, I see technology from a positive point of view. I think I mean, the history of economic growth, we raise living standards by using technology and making all of us be more efficient. So I think now it's hitting at the heart of the financial system. A system that in my mind had many inefficiencies is sometimes controlled by institutions that have a significant market power. And I think technology can be a way to make the system more efficient and in some cases diminish the market power of those institutions. Now, we need to be really careful because we have some big tech companies that might become the future banks. And those people are even more powerful than your bank. And that, to me, is a fascinating conversation that we need to have. How do we use technology without ending up just transferring all the power from our current banks to the big tech companies that certainly have the skills and the ability to dominate everything, including payments and the financial system?
Yeah, that's certainly the irony of the situation we're in is there's so much conversation and narrative about democratized finance, or as you put it earlier, the term you are not so comfortable with. And yet it could actually turn out with the exact opposite, as you just related. So we definitely need to be on our toes going forward.
Yep.
Well, Antonio, if folks want to find more of your work, where can they track you down on the great World Wide Web?
Well, they can find me a little bit everywhere. I'm on Twitter, and my handle is Antonio Fatas, very easy. And if you Google my name, you can find my website. And on my website, I always post all my research writings over there.
Okay, fabulous. Great. Well, again, thanks for taking time out of your day this morning.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that's a wrap. If you like what we do here, make sure to like, subscribe, rate, and review. It's the best way to help us get our content out to the most people, and that way we can keep doing this every week. So we look forward to seeing you next time, and thanks again.